Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We have two interesting stories for you today. We hope you will listen carefully and then try saying the words the way we do. To make it easier for you to listen and learn, we speak slower than normal and we use fewer words that are easy to understand. Let's get ready with part one of today's As It Is program from the Voice of America in Washington. As we age, we often take longer to recover from injuries. Well, some people do. But after a Japanese woman suffered a knee injury, she decided to get healthy again by becoming a competitive swimmer at age 88. Now she is nearing the age of 101, but has not slowed down. In fact, in the swimming pool, she is only getting faster. Ana Mateo tells us how this is possible.
Recently, a 100-year-old Japanese woman became the world's first centenarian to complete a 1,500-meter freestyle swimming competition in a 25-meter pool. Her name is Mieko Nageoka. Ms. Nageoka set a world record for her age group at a recent Japan Masters Swimming Association event in the western city of Matsuyama. She swam the race in 1 hour, 15 minutes, and 54 seconds. By comparison, the overall female world record holder completed the same distance in just under 15 and a half minutes. But that swimmer, Katie Ledecky, is only 17 years old. And Miss Nagaoka was not competing against her. In fact, Miss Nagaoka was the only competitor in the 100 to 104-year-old category. Her race was not a race of speed, but of endurance, or not giving up. Breaking swimming records is nothing new to Ms. Nagaoka. So far, she has broken 25 records, but she began competing when she was much younger, at 88. Ms. Nagaoka suffered a knee injury in her 80s, so she began swimming to help her body recover. Since her first international swimming competition, she hasn't looked back, except maybe to see if her competition is catching up. In 2002, at a Masters swim meet in New Zealand, Ms. Nagaoka took the bronze medal in the 50-meter backstroke. In 2004, she won 3 silver medals at an Italian swim meet. Masters swimming is a special class of competitive swimming to promote health and friendship among participants. Swimmers compete within age groups of 5 years. Ms. Nagaoka says she is a serious swimmer and a serious competitor. An article from the Reuters News Service quotes her profile on the international swimming website, FINA, saying Ms. Nagaoka trains 4 times a week for 2 hours at a time. Japan has a large number of people who live beyond 100 years old. Until she passed away this month, the oldest person in the world was also from Japan. Mizawa Okawa was born in 1898. She said her secrets for longevity, or long life, were good genes, regular sleep, sushi, and exercise. I'm Anna Mateo.
That is really quite amazing. Thanks, Anna. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now, we have a bit of American history for you. During the 1800s, the Mississippi River was crowded with steamboats. The river divided the United States in half, separating the older, more populated eastern states from the west. Steamboats transported goods and people up and down the waterway. But only a few such boats can be seen there today. This month marks the 40th year that one of them has been operating on the mighty Mississippi. Christopher Jones Cruz has more.
Steamboat Natchez was built in 1975. The Natchez is made mostly of steel. Its steam engines came from a boat that was built in 1925. Today, the Natchez carries people who want to learn what life was like in the 1800s on the Mississippi River. In those days, the arrival of a steamboat was announced by a steam-powered organ called a calliope. Clark Hawley is 79 years old. He is known as Doc. He was the first captain of the Natchez.
In the days before mass communication, a lot of these little river towns didn't have a weekly newspaper, let alone a daily newspaper. But when you played the calliope, everybody in town knew the boat was there.
Doc Hawley is now retired, but he still sails on the boat as the calliope player.
There were steamboats that carried people, steamboats that pushed barges, steamboats. There were sawmill steamboats that went from farm to farm, plantation to plantation, sawing up wood. Farmer Brown wants to build a new barn. He's got to go 40, 50 miles to get to the closest sawmill. Boat comes right to the front yard and grinds it. There were showboats that put on shows and melodramas before movies. There were gospel boats, believe it or not, that went from town to town taking up collections.
Donald Holton is the current captain of the Natchez. He says he is honored to be one of the few steamboat captains in the country.
It's just one-of-a-kind thing, you know, running a true steamboat in the port of New Orleans with a busy harbor and showing people the Mississippi River and where the Battle of New Orleans was fought, and the whole reason the city is here because of the Mississippi River and steamboats.
Passengers can dance and listen to jazz music. Jazz was born in the city of New Orleans, which is often called the Big Easy. Doc Hawley says this is how life was when many steamboats sailed up and down the river.
It was a way of life, and it's still amazingly a way of life, people who live along the river, you know.
Because the Natchez is so well cared for, it could keep paddling up and down the Mississippi for many years to come. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Environment and science report. Large governmental organizations controlled the production of seeds in Africa for many years. Owners of small farms had to buy their seeds from these agencies. But now there is an effort to make seeds from other suppliers available to African farmers. The new improved seeds might someday help Africa feed itself. Edward Mumbaya grew up in Zimbabwe. There were 10 children in his family. His father was a construction worker. His mother farmed their land. He says the small farm was very successful because his mother used different kinds of seeds. He says it was a time when many new kinds of seeds were coming into Zimbabwe. He said some farmers began to use them and increased their crop production. Mr. Mumbaya said his parents used the money earned from those crops to send all their children to school. Mr. Mumbaya is now a researcher at Cornell University in New York. He is working on a project that he hopes will give other small farmers the same chance his parents had. He leads the African Seed Access Index, TESI, which researches Africa's seed industry. The organization was launched in March. It is a joint effort of Cornell University, a nonprofit group called Market Matters, Inc., and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. TESI hopes to provide improved seeds to owners of small farms. Mr. Mumbaya says Africa's seed industry is complex and can be inefficient. He says TESI will try to identify areas of the industry that can be improved. Some private seed developers are operating in Africa, but not many, and they have not worked to develop new seeds. Most farmers in Africa use the same seeds they have been planting for many years, unlike farmers in the Western world. The seeds have not been improved to resist disease or tolerate drought. George Bagurwa works at the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA. He says there are not enough improved seeds in Africa to supply the millions of farmers who need them.
I remember when before AGRA came in some countries like Burkina Faso, like Mali, even Ghana, there were no seed companies. At least today, you have an average of about 6 to 8 seed companies in place. However, looking at the amount of seed each company produces, that is still very little.
He says improved seeds can help small farmers increase their production by 6 times. Mr. Mumbaya says this difference can be enough to help farmers who are now growing just enough food to feed their families. He says instead they could grow crops to sell as well. He says that could help them escape poverty. Mr. Mumbaya says there is still much work to be done to fully develop Africa's seed industry. But he says if seed companies and farmers in Africa continue to use the same agricultural technology the rest of the world uses, Africa will someday be able to feed itself. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. The stock market crash of 1929 marked the beginning of the worst economic crisis in American history. Millions of people lost their jobs. Thousands lost their homes. During the next several years, a large part of the richest nation on earth learned what it meant to be poor. Workers lost their jobs as factories closed. Business owners lost their stores and sometimes their homes. Farmers lost their land as they struggled with falling prices and natural disasters. And Americans were not the only ones who suffered. This week in our series, we talk about the economic crisis that became the Great Depression.
One of America's greatest writers, John Steinbeck, described the Depression this way. It was a terrible, troubled time. I can't think of any 10 years in history when so much happened in so many directions. Violent change took place. Our country was shaped. Our lives changed. Our government rebuilt. Steinbeck, winner of the 1962 Nobel Prize in Literature, said, "When the market fell, the factories, mines, and steelworks closed, and then no one could buy anything, not even food."
An unemployed auto worker in Detroit, Michigan, described the situation this way. "Before daylight, we were on the way to the Chevrolet factory to look for work. The police were already there, waving us away from the office. They were saying, 'Nothing doing, no jobs, no jobs.' So now we were walking slowly through the falling snow to the employment office for the Dodge Auto Company. A big, well-fed man in a heavy overcoat stood at the door. 'No, no,' he said. 'There was no work.' One Texas farmer lost his farm and moved his family to California to look for work. 'We can't send the children to school,' he said, 'because they have no clothes.'"
"Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dear, it's the shadow. White flowers will never awaken you, not where the black coach of sorrow has taken you."
The economic crisis began with the stock market crash in October 1929. For the first year, the economy fell very slowly. But it dropped sharply in 1931 and 1932. And by the end of 1932, the economy collapsed almost completely. During the 3 years following the stock market crash, the value of goods and services produced in America fell by almost half. The wealth of the average American dropped to a level lower than it had been 25 years earlier. All the gains of the 1920s were washed away. Unemployment rose sharply. The number of workers looking for a job jumped from 3% to more than 25% in just 4 years. One of every three or four workers was looking for a job in 1932.
Those employment numbers did not include farmers. The men and women who grew the nation's food suffered terribly during the Great Depression. This was especially true in two states, Oklahoma and Texas. Farmers there were losing money because of falling prices for their crops. Then natural disasters struck. Year after year, little or no rain fell. The ground dried up, and then the wind blew away the earth in huge clouds of dust. All that dust made some of the farmers leave, one Oklahoma farmer remembered later. But my family stayed. We fought to live. Despite all the dust and the wind, we were planting seeds. But we got no crops. We had 5 crop failures in 5 years.
Falling production, rising unemployment, men begging in the streets. But there was more to the Great Depression. At that time, the federal government did not guarantee the money that people put in banks. When people could not repay loans, banks began to close. In 1929, 659 banks, with total holdings of $200 million, went out of business. The next year, 2 times that number failed. And the year after that, almost twice that number of banks went out of business. Millions of people lost all their savings. They had no money left.
The Depression caused serious public health problems. Hospitals across the country were filled with sick people whose main illness was a lack of food. The health department in New York City found that 1 of every 5 of the city's children did not get enough food. 99% of the children attending a school in a coal mining area of the country reportedly were underweight. In some places, people died of hunger. The quality of housing also fell. Families were forced to crowd into small houses or apartments to share costs. Many people had no homes at all. They slept on public streets, buses, or trains. One official in Chicago reported in 1931 that several hundred women without homes were sleeping in city parks. In a number of cities, people without homes built their houses from whatever materials they could find. They used empty boxes or pieces of metal to build shelters in open areas.
People called these areas of little temporary houses Hoovervilles. They blamed President Hoover for their situation. So, too, did the men forced to sleep in public parks at night. They covered themselves with pieces of paper, and they called the paper Hoover blankets. People without money in their pants called their empty pockets Hoover flags. People blamed President Hoover because they thought he was not doing enough to help them. Hoover did take several actions to try to improve the economy, But he resisted proposals for the federal government to provide aid in a major way. And he refused to let the government spend more money than it earned. Hoover told the nation, "Economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive decision." Many conservative Americans agreed with him, but not the millions of Americans who were hungry and tired of looking for a job. They accused Hoover of not caring about common citizens. One congressman from Alabama said, "In the White House, we have a man more interested in the money of the rich than in the stomachs of the poor."
On and on, the Great Depression continued. Of course, some Americans were lucky. They kept their jobs, and they had enough money to enjoy the lower prices of most goods. Many people shared their earnings with friends in need. Years later, John Steinbeck wrote, "It seems odd now to say that we rarely had a job. There just weren't any jobs." But he continued, "Given the sea and the gardens, we did pretty well with a minimum of theft. We didn't have to steal much." Farmers could not sell their crops, he explained, so they gave away all the fruit and vegetables that people could carry home.
Other Americans reacted to the crisis by leading protests against the economic policies of the Hoover administration. In 1932, a large group of former soldiers gathered in Washington to demand help. More than 8,000 of them built the nation's largest Hooverville near the White House. Federal troops finally removed them by force and burned their shelters.
"Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?"
Next week, we will look at how the Great Depression of the 1930s affected other countries.
"Went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?"
This program was written by David Drummel. I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Barbara Klein. You can find our series online with pictures, transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.